You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
Time to check in with Jim Ellis, ellisinsight.com, for a look at the week in politics. And Jim, we have a guest with us this week, Rob Miney, public affairs consultant out of Las Vegas, so we can hone in on what just happened in Nevada. Jim, good to talk with you.
Well, always my pleasure, Larry. It was quite a night, a little bit of a surprise in terms of what happened on the Republican side, but Rob there is on the ground, voted in that primary, so maybe he could give us a better idea of what actually happened when he was actually there.
Yeah, Rob, what happened here? We thought that here we have two things. I know we have the beauty contest, the one where you vote for, you know, everybody gets to vote for. Then you have the caucus side, and you had Nikki Haley, kind of the candidate for that, expected to win that, and not in the one that counts. She doesn't even win the one that she's in.
Yeah, well, it is interesting to look back and try to figure out what the advisors to Governor Haley were even thinking, why they got into the primary instead of the caucus. It could have just been a mistake. But I think what you see here, Larry, and it's probably not particularly surprising given the national environment, is a conclusion that particular contest essentially is over. I think there is an enthusiasm gap among the whole electorate to some extent, but far more so on the Democratic side and far more so on the side of anyone other than President Trump. It is palpable when you go to these events, when you wait in line at a polling station, there is real enthusiasm, from my perspective, only one place. I had a friend I work with who said he saw his first Biden sign ever the other day and had never seen a Haley sign. And I really think the message from the voters in this, kind of a beauty contest primary is, look, let's put this behind us and let's look forward to the fall. And I really think there's not a lot of tolerance for this ongoing, attempt to pretend we're going to nominate someone else. I think that's the biggest factor at play.
Over to you, Jim. Now, Jim, as we record this, Nikki Haley is not expected to drop out. She has said she's in for it going into South Carolina. You just have to do better than you did before. And she's not looking to do very well there either.
I would be surprised, frankly, if she continues to South Carolina, because all the polling, which has been accurate so far, it's all predicted Trump big wins. And he's up almost 2-1 on her in her home state. And I'm not sure if she wants to go through that embarrassment. And how does that allow her to set up better for 2028? I'm sure we will hear from her again in the next presidential election. And I would think she has some soul searching to do. So it wouldn't shock me before the February 24th South Carolina primary that she decides to get out of the race.
Funding for a border plan hasn't been approved, and that means funding for Ukraine tied with it, not moving forward. Take us into that story. Things can change, but it looks as if this plan was dead on arrival. It really didn't do much to secure the border, but it lines people up to say the other guy is at fault.
Well, I was just going to say, I think that's something else, Jim and Larry, that puts a little wind at the former president's back at this point. Part of his appeal, I believe, is seen around the loss of faith in institutions in general, certainly in government in particular. And those people who pay close attention know that the border deal doesn't do much to really secure the border. Anything that lets in, 5,000-7,000, depending on the part of the bill you look at, of people illegally on any given day, it can be considered a border, closing effort. And I do think you hit it on the nose, Larry. I think part of it is, let's find something to blame the other side for. And it kind of plays into the whole narrative that we need to drain the swamp and we need some people that are non-traditional politicians in charge. I think that's a real top-of-mind issue for people in the Senate.
Yeah. But, Jim, for Biden to get up there and say it's Trump and MAGA Republicans on the border, when the border, for the most part, had been slowed down, not to a total stop, but pretty well under Trump. And then immediately Biden goes and rescinds things like Remain in Mexico. How is he expecting everybody to have a little memory?
Yes, and it generally works, Larry. I think, though, that this is another indication, though, of what we can expect from the Biden administration. So look what they're doing on the oil and gas production is way up now because they need to have the price of oil come down for the election. They need to have some type of border legislation on the table just so they can say, oh, it's the other side's fault for not passing our bill. We had a bill. When really Biden can do most of what this bill would have done just by saying, I want this done. He has the power to do that, as Trump did.
Yeah.
So I think we're going to see more and more of this, and we're going to see the Fed lower interest rates, and it's all designed to make Biden look better for the election. So as usual, what the policy that from the Biden administration all relates back to their political prospects. Yeah. And this also tells us the fact that they were willing to move a border bill for the first time since he's gotten in office is that that issue is really hurting them politically, and that's why they're doing it.
Yeah. At the time we record this, in a dramatic setback, House Republicans failed to impeach Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas. The vote forced Republicans to shelve a high-profile priority. Jim, you and I have talked about this. You never are supposed to vote until you know you have the votes to get something through, or it looks like embarrassment, unless they're outsmarting us, and this was actually the plan. I mean, Jim, what do you think here?
I don't think they're outsmarting us. I think they had another bad vote count on this, and also because the margin now is so close, because we've had some resignations, and the Republicans are really down to they can only lose 3 votes from their side on any bill right now, because the Democrats vote like robots. They all vote together. So we had, I think, a miscount from the whip team there in the leadership, and it ended up into a 215-215 vote. Then Congressman Blake Moore from Utah, who's part of the leadership, changed his vote from yes to no on the impeachment for Mayorkas. And the reason he did that at the leadership's direction is because now, because he's a no vote, he and all the no votes have the right to ask for reconsideration. So I think we'll see this vote come up again when they're a little bit more comfortable and confident of their vote count.
Rob, your take on what's happening with the Republicans. Jim and I have talked about the fact that even if you do impeach Mayorkas, there's not a chance that over on the Senate side, where the trial would have to be held, that he'd actually be convicted. Is this all theater? Jim has suggested, well, it gets the information out there. It forces some of the media to have to cover this story a bit about Mayorkas. What's your take on what has happened here, Rob Biney?
I think the fact is there are a lot of issues that is very important for one caucus or the other to get on record. And I think to some extent, even having an attempt at least an effort to keep the issue front and center. It keeps people focused on the fact that the border is open and that the people who are serving us and positions requiring enforcement aren't doing their jobs. The fact that the vote failed isn't ideal, obviously, but I do think it's something that the leadership considers to be good to have on record. That said, I think the difficulty and the challenge becomes when you look like that's all you're doing. The Democratic Party appears to be trying to portray the Republican leadership as the party of no. They need to be the party of we've got a better idea. They need to be for something. And so I think it's good to go on record on some of those things, but if you hang your hat on it, so to speak, that's not a winning formula. So I think there's a lot of people probably overthinking some of these things, but my view is that if the vote never comes up again, they've still made a little bit of a message, sent a little bit of a message, but that's not what you run on. You run on, here is our solution. Here are the reasons that you can look for a better future ahead for your family. And we always say at every election, but the kitchen table issues are extremely important. You wait in a line to hear people talking about the price of, you know, the price of milk. You know, groceries are up about 20% since Biden took office. You know, they brag about the rate coming down. Well, it's already, you know, prices have already come up. Prices aren't coming down. And you look at the general feeling of insecurity, and I think those things are going to carry the day.
Lots of fun. Rob Miney, public affairs consultant out of Las Vegas. Thank you so much. Jim Ellis, ellisinsight.com.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Several other big stories this week. The Supreme Court heard arguments this week on whether Donald Trump is eligible to run for office based on his alleged role in the U.S. Capitol attack. Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts told the attorney for Colorado's voters that his arguments were at war with the history of the 14th Amendment.
Congress has the power to enforce it. So wouldn't that be the last place that you'd look for authorization for the states to enforce, implicitly authorized, to enforce the presidential election process?
A decision is expected soon on that fight. President Biden calling out the special counsel this past week who investigated how he handled classified documents.
I've seen the headlines since the report was released about my willful retention of documents. These assertions are not only misleading, they're just plain wrong.
That's technically what the report said. The special counsel wrote that he felt that Biden's memory was, quote, significantly limited, and also raising questions as to if he remembered the timing of his son's death. Biden said that when he was asked that question, he did not think it was anyone's business on the matter. He pushed back at questions regarding how his age might not make him the top choice to defeat former President Trump in this year's election, to which he replied,
I'm the most qualified person in this country to be president of the United States and finish the job I started.
Texas Republican Congressman Pat Fallon says the report is troubling.
I'm really alarmed because the fate of humanity rests upon the job that the person that holds this office does, and Joe Biden is clearly incapable of it.
He says the report detailing Biden's memory is worrisome as well.
Certain memories are seared into your mind if you're healthy. And that is like when, unfortunately, your son dies. You know the year. You know when you served as vice president of the United States.
Former President Trump says the lack of charges in President Biden's special counsel report is selective prosecution. Trump wrote, this is now proven to be a two-tiered system of justice and unconstitutional selective prosecution. He also said Biden's case is different and more severe than his own. Trump faces an indictment for allegedly obstructing the government's efforts to retrieve documents.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
Congressman Mike Garcia represents the 27th Congressional District, and he is joining us right now. Thanks so much for taking time to be with us on our program.
Thanks for having me, Larry. I appreciate you.
Well, Senate Republicans declared the bipartisan border bill dead on arrival. Senator Ted Cruz of Texas said if passed, the legislation would normalize illegal immigration and hamstring future presidents. It's like 300 and some pages, and apparently people have started reading this thing, right?
Yeah, it's a dog. And the fundamental problem is that it's not a border bill. It's an immigration bill. And it's not a standalone bill. It's coupled up with a few ugly babies as well. And the sum total of this supplemental comes out to about $110 billion overall. So with very little of that going towards border security. So look, the problem is that all roads lead to the White House when it comes to the border. You can take all the field trips to the border. The press can see it. We all know it's a crisis. There's about 10,000 people a day coming across the border. The problem is not there. The true source, the root cause of the problem is at the White House. It's in the Oval Office. This is Biden's open border policy being realized now for 3 years. He ran on this open border policy. So it's not a money problem. Frankly, it's not even a legislation problem. The president right now has the authority to implement all of the laws and enforce the border security to keep people from coming into our country, and us effectively enabling that. He can reinstate the remain in Mexico policy. He can stop the catch and release policy. He can stop giving airline tickets and free phones to people who come here illegally. He can change the parole and asylum processes. It already exists under the current authorities of the executive branch. The House has passed H.R. 2, which is a very strong actual border bill to secure the border. But we can't, do what the Senate bill is doing, which is basically nothing. It's basically an immigration bill, and we need a border bill right now. So let's fix the immigration stuff after we fix the border. I liken it to a leaking pipe, right? If you have a giant leaking pipe under your sink, you don't start mopping the water up before you start fixing the leak under the sink. You have to stop the leak, and then you can start mopping the water up. The giant leak is at our southern border.
I love those plumber analogies. Yeah, there you go. And of course, we got to stop the flow of illegal immigrants, right? Okay. There's one, I don't know if it was New York's mayor. Somebody wants to give $1,000 in money to illegals, too, to give them some cash.
Yeah, well, our own governor, Governor Newsom, just a couple weeks ago was talking about something like, you know, billions of dollars for free health care for illegals, right? We already are a sanctuary state. L.A. is a sanctuary city, so we are already giving them sanctuary. We are already giving them resources in the form of, you know, welfare programs and education programs. And there's a lot of criminals already here. So the simple fact is that 10,000 people, about 7 million people are now within our borders who are not Americans, and we don't have accountability for them. Some of them are bad guys. There's close to 100 people who have been apprehended that are on the known terror watch list. So even these blue states and blue cities, like you said, the mayor of New York is now, you know, starting to realize this is unsustainable and unaffordable. Yeah.
And then there's the images. When you see images of illegals whacking police officers, something's wrong there. You know, you're in this country, you asked to get in, you wanted asylum, and here you are attacking our police, and then hearing that nothing happens to you when you do that. That's also shocking Americans.
Yeah, and I think one of them, when he was released, actually flipped off the cameras, which is, you know, effectively flipping off the entire country as he's being released, with zero cash bail policies in that area. So, yeah, you know, this is fundamentally the problem right now. This is a crisis that this president has created. This is a man-made problem. This problem will not change unless we get a new president in office. And we have one of the weakest executives in the Oval Office right now. He ran on an open border policy. We have realized the absolute deleterious effects of this open border policy for 3 years. And there's an election coming here. So people need to.
I look at it this way. Biden, by them being shipped all over, has made the border issue one for every state. And now, you know, we've had this issue in the border of Texas with the wire, and you have the governor down there putting up the razor wire, and a Supreme Court decision not on the merits of the case, saying, no, the feds can come in, but not saying that he can't put it back up. And you've got all these Republican governors from around the country who are backing Texas. You've got yourself a constitutional crisis thanks to Biden, don't we?
Yeah, we absolutely do. And, you know, the Constitution says that the federal government will provide for the general welfare of its people, that it will provide for the common defense, and it will secure our borders. And when the federal government is led by human beings in the Oval Office, like Joe Biden, who has effectively said he will not do those things, then he is effectively putting the states in a position where they have to protect themselves. And then he goes back and says, well, that's not constitutional. That's my job, is to protect you, right? So we've got ourselves into a constitutional do loop here. And I don't blame the states for wanting to protect themselves. This is something that the federal government should be doing. This is something that the executive branch in the federal government should be doing. And he's forcing executives like Governor Abbott in Texas to do his job, him being Joe Biden. So that is fundamentally where we're at. And God bless anyone who's trying to procure security for the nation, especially under an administration that's frankly derelict in its right. duty of providing that security.
And so much was there. The wall was almost completed. You had Remain in Mexico that was in place. Things that Biden stopped day one, and then he says, oh, I got to have all this money. And then we turn out to find out the bill is more about processing in illegals more effectively. Come on. I mean, either you're going
to giving millions, you know, providing millions, authorizing millions for ankle bracelets that they know how to take off, right, before they arrive in court.
Exactly.
It's a ridiculous bill. It will die in the Senate, hopefully, before, you know, we certainly won't support it in the House.
All right. To Israel, to Iran, to the three Americans we lost recently and the Biden response, take us into that story and some thoughts you have.
Yeah, so obviously, just over a week ago now, a couple weeks ago, we lost three Americans who were actually based in Jordan, who were killed by an unmanned vehicle, a drone that flew into Tower 22 facilities, and unfortunately was undetected and unmolested, meaning it was completely left to strike the tower, killed three Americans. I also would like to remind people there are dozens of Americans were killed on October 7th in Israel during the Hamas raids into Israel as well on what was effectively their 9/11. So we have now had over 50 attacks on military installations in the Middle East between Iraq and Syria, Jordan, by what is being called Iranian proxies. And this administration has reacted at some levels and with strike, kinetic strike missile attacks against some of these Iranian proxies, but not directly at anyone who controls these Iranian proxies. And what I'd like to see is the United States get a little more aggressive. You don't have to start a war, but you can have accountability through kinetic means to deter these proxies from continuing to attack American facilities. The only thing that these proxies really respect and will be a meaningful deterrent is if you go after Iranian leadership, either inside or outside of Iranian borders, that actually control these proxies. Once you do that, you will start seeing some of these attacks getting tampered down. But the bottom line is that the Middle East has become a powder keg. It is it was at the end of the last administration at least stable, and we have put ourselves back in a condition now where the Middle East is probably the most unstable it's been, and that's this own administration right now. This Biden administration saying it themselves probably in three decades. So. We've got to pay attention, and more importantly, we've got to protect our troops, but we've got to hold those who go after our troops accountable. And this administration so far is not doing that at the levels that I think are commensurate with the deaths of so many Americans. Yeah.
Some people say that this latest round all started when the Biden administration gave Iran billions of dollars in a prisoner swap, albeit they claim it's their money, but we didn't have to do that, but we did it anyway. And doesn't that give them the money then to give to the proxies to fund whatever military operations they take against us?
Yeah, that certainly paid for it. I would argue that this began with Afghanistan. It was aggravated when Biden, told the Russians it depends on how big of an encroachment into Ukraine you make. That'll determine our outcome. We have established ourselves as weak on the global stage, and we now have chaos through weakness rather than peace through strength. And this is a 3-year-long product now. That prisoner swap put a value of about $1.2 billion on every American head. We traded 5 Americans for $6 billion, and it freed up cash for Iran to go pay for these proxy operations. So, again, this was just a continuation of putting America last, of knocking us down a couple of notches on the global stage. But this administration needs to reverse course here. These aren't insolvable problems, but it does require someone besides Jake Sullivan, who knows nothing about national security, to step up and start leading. And, we have a Secretary of Defense, unfortunately, who was MIA for an operation that his boss and his direct reports didn't even know about. So this is it's a scary administration to be, running a nation under such tumultuous circumstances, and this is why we need a new administration as soon as possible.
Yeah, when you talk about going into the hospital and not letting the administration or others know, and then saying your excuse is, "Oh, the president has a lot on his plate. I didn't want to bother him." Doesn't really cut it.
Yeah,
does
unreal.
It? Yeah,
unreal. No, I called for his resignation. I mean, any troop below him had any soldier, army, navy, sailor, air force, airman done the same thing, they would have been forced to resign their commission.
Can you imagine that? Offices. I don't want to bother you. Can you imagine if there's a leak at a nuclear power plant? I don't want to bother my
supervisor. Yeah, I didn't want to bother you. Yeah.
That's your job to bother. It's not a bother. Let us know.
That's right.
There are other people who can do this. And you're not so valuable that you're the only one who, you let people know and other people can be put in place and the conversation can take place. But, yeah. And then, of course, nothing happens to them.
A chain of command is no chain at all if the link in the very most critical part of that role is just MIA. The strength of the cable depends on the weakness of the weakest link, and in this case, the Secretary of Defense is the weakest link, unfortunately. Yeah. So we need to fix a lot of these problems, obviously.
We do indeed. Mike Garcia represents the 27th congressional district. Remember that? 27th Congressional District. Used to be 25. I follow along as things move around there. Thank you for taking time, and we'll have you back.
Thanks, Larry. Appreciate you. Take care.
Coming up, we'll meet a Southern California school board member facing a recall and important congressional districts for Republicans.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino. AM 590, The Answer. You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
He is the chair of the Orange County Republican Party, Fred Whitaker, joining us as ballots will soon be arriving in the mail. Good to have you on. Nice to have you on our program again.
Thanks, Larry. Always great to be with you.
It's not election day. It's election season, and Republicans have finally realized that, haven't they? They're working to get people to vote early and get their ballots in, right?
Yeah, we call it secure a ballot because it's really not election day. It's election month. You know, in just a couple of days, everybody will receive a ballot in their mail. And if we can get Republicans to turn their ballots back in early, that saves our volunteers time. It saves our campaign efforts money in terms of chasing those voters. We can go after the low propensity voters and work on them. Our high propensity voters, we want you to turn your ballots in early so that we don't have to spend time and money chasing you on the last day.
Right. A little hint here. If you don't like getting all those cards and mailers, if you get your vote in, apparently those lists are reviewed before more mailers are sent out and you can stop getting all the mail, right?
Absolutely. In Orange County in particular, we get the daily update. So we understand which voters have voted. They come off the phoning list. They come off the mail list. And so if you don't want to get bugged, get your vote in early.
A little motivation there. All right. Get the lay of the land, because we cover a large geographic area. You're going to specifically focus on Orange County, but what's the lay of the land this upcoming election? What's out there? What are the issues? What are the candidates, the districts? Kind of describe what's up this time.
Well, you know, for California, we're often ignored in the presidential race because it's such a blue state. But what California does is we actually provided the 5-seat majority to the House of Representatives. So our focus here in Orange County and across the state is maintaining the Republican congressional seats that were picked up in the last two cycles, as well as gaining more. And in Orange County, that means we're going to protect Congressional 45 with Michelle Steele. We're going to protect Congressional 40 with Young Kim. We're going to win Congressional 47 with Scott Baugh. That's the former Katie Porter seat. She's not running for that seat. She's running off in the U.S. Senate. And Scott is the number one challenger among Republicans in the entire nation. He has more cash on hand than any Republican challenger in the nation. He's raised more than any Republican challenger in the nation. Our latest polls, he's well ahead of the Democrat, has more than twice as much cash on hand as the Democrat. That district is almost even in Republican-Democrat registration. We are very confident and are working very hard to make sure we take that seat back. And then you go a little further south in Congressional 49. We have four great Republicans running. We'll see who wins the primary to go against Mike Levin. Levin is not a fit for that district. He's uber progressive when that district is pretty moderate. And so I think in a good year, we'll have a good shot at taking Congressional 49 as well. So we are going to be and have been the contributors to the Republican majority in the House of Representatives. And that's what we can do here in California and Orange County.
Are there some key issues that everybody's running on that are kind of a winner for Republican side? I mean, I can't put them out there, but I mean, we've been facing awful inflation in this area. The border issues. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that's not right now that if you reach the right voter with the right message, you should have a pretty good chance.
Oh, absolutely. We've been doing a lot of polling to figure out what is of concern to the voter, not just the Republican voter, but your average voter, your no party preference voter, even moderate Democrat. And, certainly crime and homelessness is affecting everybody. Just even when you walk in the parking lot of the supermarket. Certainly the border crisis is a concern to everyone. And then the cost of living. I mean, you really essentially hit the top three. And it doesn't matter which area of the county. There's always going to be little nuances in regions as to which issues are top of mind versus second or third. But those are the top three. with education right behind it at number four. And with those issues, we are right on with the voters, and the Democrats aren't. So if we have message-disciplined candidates, we're going to win.
The Democrats seem to have two topics, Trump and abortion, as their issues. Are Republicans, do they have the message down to counter it? Because sometimes I feel like Republicans don't always have a clear message. They get a little confused. They're either afraid to, you know, say, I'm going to vote for this guy, or they don't know how to address it. Are the Republicans being worked with to get the right message out?
Well, absolutely. All our candidates are being trained, and some of them, you know, don't do as well as they need to, or, you know, they have to get through it a little bit. It's no secret that President Trump doesn't do well in California. I think after Iowa and New Hampshire, it's very clear President Trump is going to be the nominee. And to me, that actually takes that issue somewhat off the table. We can focus local voters on local races because the presidential race has really been decided. And so if we focus on what matters to the local voters, we'll be like Michelle Steele or Young Kim in 2020, when, despite President Trump losing in Orange County, they got more votes than President Trump. And Michelle Steele even got more votes than President Biden. So when you message correctly, despite what's going on at the national level, you can actually do very well.
Yeah.
And then I think with respect to abortion and right to life, you just need to be absolutely clear what your position is. We know California, especially with ACA 1 last cycle, is a very pro-choice state. But most Republicans are pro-life. But we're also constitutionalists. And constitutionalists agree with the Dobbs decision that it went back to the states. And you know, I think Scott Baugh's got the right message on it. Steve Garvey has the right message on it, that, you know, a Republican from a state like California should not be voting for a nationwide ban because that's not constitutional. Constitutional is each state gets to determine a moral issue like that.
Right, right. In fact, I saw, you know how you get these emails. For somehow or another, I got on the list for the other side. So, I mean, I get to see what they write. And in their letters to raise money, they go, oh, Republicans are going to vote for a nationwide ban. You're right. It's been decided by the courts. It's not a nationwide ban. It's a state ban. And you mentioned Steve Garvey. I want to talk about his run for the Senate. He recently took part in a debate. Yeah, got some not so great reviews by, you know, the typical people who watch your savvy and how quick you are on your feet. But he's not a professional debater, but he was pretty clear on what he believes, right?
Absolutely. And I think by the time you look at the last 40 minutes of the debate as opposed to the first 40 minutes of the debate, he got more comfortable in his shoes there and being on the debate stage. And I think he parried fairly well with Katie Porter, especially near the end. And so by the time they have the second debate, I think, you know, some of those naysayers about, you know, how quick he was to respond to things, the second debate will be much more like the second half of this debate. He's very clear on what his beliefs are. I think when you read the written analysis of his answers, versus the others, he is the only common sense candidate that has a chance to win. And for Republicans, it's critically important that we get somebody in the top two. In 2016, when we had Loretta Sanchez versus Kamala Harris for U.S. Senate, the drop-off in the vote from President Trump on the top of the ballot to our legislative candidates and our school boards and our city councils down there was dramatic. Your average voter who's not very involved and maybe only comes out on presidential elections, unless we have somebody to vote for all the way down the chain, they have a hard time. And we need those voters to stay with us all the way down ballot. And so while the state party and the county party have not endorsed, we have several Republicans running in the primary. We need to have somebody win that second position so that we have a voice for Republican voters to vote for in the fall election. Right. And right now that looks like Steve Garvey's the person.
Well, here is from the debate. This is Congresswoman Barbara Lee arguing that President Biden is doing all he can when it comes to the border. Take a listen.
The president is trying to get Republicans, mind you, to step up and support over $1 billion to make sure that immigrants are treated fairly.
So it's not even about closing the border. It's the Democrats' line is they want more money to be able to process them in. And here's Garvey knocking it out of the park, pun intended.
Where have you all been the last 3 years? 4 years ago, 1,000 immigrants were coming across the border. Today, between 10 to 15 to 20,000 illegal immigrants are coming across the border.
How the Democrats up on the stage just stand there owning it. You know, isn't immigration a great thing? Blah, blah, blah. No, yes, immigration is a great thing. Legal and organized and vetted. But Democrats won't connect the two. They want open borders. I mean, it's just so obvious.
Yeah, absolutely. They're so out of touch with your average voter, even your average Democrat, center-left Democrat, and especially those who are working class and understand wage pressures and increased taxes to pay for social services. The incredible open border with no vetting of who's coming in and how you know society is going to pay for them makes no sense. And so it is a strong issue. People derided President Trump back in 2016 when he made this a national issue. It's only gotten worse since then. The Biden administration is 10 times worse than the Obama administration was in terms of having a completely open border. Right. And, you know, especially border towns in Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, and even some of California.
Right, right, right. And when you listen to the debate, Democrats are shocked that someone would bus people off their border as if they should be forced to leave everyone teeming in their state and have their state turned into a Democrat state. Not fair. I mean, come on, share the burden. And these places like New York and Chicago are feeling the heat. And even those are, you know, being directed to send their complaints to the Biden administration. Out of time. If people want to find out more in Orange County, where can they go to learn about the candidates? Is there one central place or what should they do?
Absolutely. Thanks, Larry. It's www.ocgop.org. That's ocgop.org.
Fred Whitaker, thank you.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
Madison Minor and Rick Ledesma are Orange County Unified School Board members currently facing a California Teachers Union-backed recall. The vote will occur on March 5th, 2024. And we are going to talk with Madison right now. Madison, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Larry. I appreciate it.
I am told this recall was initiated because you and Rick and the conservative board majority passed a transgender notification policy for parents, created a parents' bill of rights for curriculum transparency, and passed a flag policy so only state and federal flags would be flown on campus. Is this what happened?
Yeah, so I know a lot of people call it a transgender policy, but we wanted to focus on the bigger dynamic, and that would be gender dysmorphic individuals. So, you know, individuals that are just not comfortable in their own body and want to make a change when it comes to their gender on their official records, their name, a bathroom choice, or a locker room choice for them. They want to switch. And so, yes, we passed a parent notification policy so that if someone is struggling with gender dysmorphia, that they are, you know, their parents, their most important people in their lives are included in the conversation.
And you're not alone. Your district is not alone. I read about others across the state who have kind of done the same thing.
Yeah, there's I believe, a total of 9 or 10 districts who have passed a similar policy to ours, you know, with different names, different words in there. But yes, we are not alone in that.
All right. So set up the two sides, if we can get this on this story. There's one side who believes, your side, that parents should have the right to be aware of this. The other side says, no, they don't. Right?
Right. Yeah. So a lot of people are saying that it's an outing policy, that we are, you know, prematurely outing a child to their parent if they are choosing to make a change. That's the argument on the other side. However, the argument that I give is if a student is with their counselor and with their principal and their teacher from 8 a.m. to 3 p.m., where are they from 3 p.m. until 8 a.m.? They're with their parents. And so if it's true, if the statistic on the National Suicide Hotline is true, there is a very, very high suicidality rate for children suffering with gender dysmorphia. And so if that's the case, the parent is home with them, you know, who's not going to alert a parent if they find their child, you know, attempting to commit suicide and have no idea why? That's dangerous. That's incredibly dangerous. And a parent is going to get them the help that they need, you know, take them to counseling, make sure that they are supported. And, you know, it might be a wake up call for some parents that need to get more involved in their child's lives, because I'll be honest, I have four kids and it is very easy to get a little bit complacent. And so a policy like this is not to out those children. It's to include them in the conversation with their parents so that they make sure that they're getting supported, at home as well as in, you know, in those areas of their lives where they're not supported by their teachers and counselors at school.
As a broader issue, is this also not a parental rights issue that it goes beyond this one particular case?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's in our Constitution that parents' rights to parent their children supersede privacy rights of a child. And according to HIPAA law, if there is a clear and present danger of for a child, then absolutely their parents should be notified. And so that's why we created this policy, to make sure that there's safety for all children. And furthermore, on that, you know, when they call it an outing policy, well, that child, you know, the janitor knows because they're using a different bathroom. The counselors know, the teachers know, the students know, because they've seen that child maybe using a different bathroom or dressing differently or asking to be using a different name. And so why wouldn't the parent also know what's going on with their student at their school? Everyone else already knows, and the parent is going to be the one to protect them best.
Have you gotten a sense, percentage-wise, of how the parents in your school district think about this issue? Are they backing you or backing them?
That's a great question. And so we've gotten a huge majority of parents thanking us for passing this notification policy. You know, they're kind of in the boat of hopeful that they don't have to utilize it, but they are grateful that we are passing a policy that includes parents as the number one advocates for their own children.
Where did the flag issue come from? I think I saw a story about this. But set this up, because I heard about some school districts where they found that they actually didn't have all the flags that they were supposed to in school, and somebody wanted to fly a different flag. What's the story behind the flag part of this?
Yeah, so the reason behind the flag is, you know, the United States of America flag is a unifying flag that includes all Americans in our country. And so of all the flags that we feel are most important to fly, it's absolutely the United States of America flag. In our policy, it does say that the California flag as well is of utmost importance, not as much as the United States flag, but it's also a flag that we encourage being flown at our campuses. And we will provide a flag for campuses that don't have one. You know, we will be the ones to, the district office will be the ones to provide that financially for each school. And if a teacher doesn't have one in their classroom, then we will provide that for them as well. You know, I'm not monitoring or babysitting these teachers, but it's just like in any relationship, I think it's good to have accountability and to have oversight. And so us as the board with our teachers, we are providing for them, you know, an opportunity for them to fly something that unifies all of our students in the classroom.
Did this come up on its own, or is there some context and a backstory to this? Because I've read about districts where a teacher on their own roguely wanted to fly a pride flag. Did that happen in your district, or are you doing this as a preemptive measure?
Yeah, more of a preemptive measure. We have really incredible teachers in our district. the vast majority are amazing. We just have a couple that, you know, are pushing ulterior agendas. And so, although I haven't specifically seen pride flags flying in classrooms, we just wanted to make sure that they understand that the classroom is for learning and for unification, and a flag that is flown otherwise is not promoting education and promoting unity. It's causing more division than helping. And so preemptively, we wanted to pass this policy to make sure our teachers and our staff, principals, you know, understand our expectations as school board members that were voted in the last election.
Madison Minor is with us along with, well, Rick Ledesma is not, but both of them are from the Orange Unified School Board, and they are members and facing a recall. Lastly, the Parents' Bill of Rights for Transparency. What is that, and what has been the reaction to getting that?
Yeah, so we've had a handful. I get emails and I get messages on social media from hundreds of parents since I was elected, even before I was elected while I was running, that told me about frustrations that they had. You know, they'd go down to the district and have to be in a specific time slot to have 2 hours to read curriculum. And so, you know, they get to read that primary reader, right? Like their textbook that the teachers are using in the classroom. But there's been a lack of transparency when it comes to secondary or supplemental instruction. For example, you know, with my kids, I don't get every worksheet home. There's worksheets and there are assignments in class that, you know, I might not ever even see just because they're not sent home necessarily. And so that supplemental or secondary instruction that is supporting the primary instruction, we just, again, with the transparency and the oversight, we were just making sure that all of our students, you know, what they're learning in class is accessible to our parents. And now our parents can go into the office and request the secondary or supplemental instruction in Orange Unified School District, and they're able to see what it is that the teachers are using to support their students in the classroom best.
Is this transparency linked to the recall in any way? Do you have any evidence to show that there are, at least the teachers' union, doesn't want this, doesn't want kids and parents to have this information transmitted home?
Yeah, so we've had, you know, some of our teachers, including our president and vice president of the teachers union in Orange Unified called OUEA. They are on record on other news sources saying, you know, for example, with the parent notification policy, saying that they will not notify a parent if this happens in their classroom, and saying that their secondary or supplemental instruction changes because of, you know, needs in the classroom. And I get that. You know, it's not sometimes as a parent, right? We kind of fly by the seat of our pants and we change things up just depending on our kids' moods. However, if a parent wants access to what their student is learning, what their own child is learning in the classroom, I think it's vital for the teacher and the parent to work as a team to show those, to show the relationship that there's trust and that there's honesty, and to make sure that the teacher is held accountable to oversight by their parents in the classroom. And so there has been some pushback by the leadership in the union, but I've had many teachers side message me, teachers that are honestly terrified of the union and the repercussions of being heckled and bullied by people in the union that have shown support for these policies.
Well, we are out of time. Again, Madison Minor with us from the Orange County, the Orange Unified School Board. You're a member there, and you're facing a recall. This will be the test. Either folks are with you or not, right? I mean, this is where it comes down to. When you represent and you have an elected board, you represent the people. And if they can garner enough support to knock you out, that's the U.S. system, apparently, right?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. So, yes, please vote no on the recall on March 5th.
All right, Madison, thank you for taking time to be with us. A very interesting debate that's going on, not only in your community, but I think maybe it's Temecula. There's some other places that are facing similar types of things right now, aren't they?
Yes, yeah. Joe Komorowski, the president, just received his recall paperwork as well.
All right. We'll see what happens. Another reason to vote in the March 5th primary, right?
Yes, sir. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino. AM 590, The Answer.